This is Ham College, episode 139, for May 8th, 2026. Ham College is brought to you by ICOM. Whether the bands are calm, crowded, or somewhere in between, when the gear stays out of your way and the contacts keep coming, you know you're in good company. Choose ICOM. Good evening. Welcome to another episode of Ham College. I'm Professor Thomas.
And I'm Dean Martin.
And we've got an action-packed show for you tonight.
Again?
At least it's going to start out that way by the time we get to the end of it. Hopefully we can coast downhill because it's going to be like three shows in one tonight.
All right. Emma, you up for the task?
We're going to find out.
I'm up for it now, but check with me about the 50-yard line. We'll see how we're working out then.
Why are we doing so many tonight?
Because we're trying to wrap up the technician pool before the end, before it expires, and which is the end of June. I think it's like June the 30th, June the 28th, something like that.
Yeah.
And anyway, trying to wrap them up so people have time to go take their tests and so forth. So we'll be finishing this one up tonight, and then next month we'll be starting on the general.
Yeah, June 30th.
So 30th-ish.
That means we're going through three groups of questions tonight. We've been doing two for the last few episodes, but you get an extra one this time around.
So you're getting triple the price of your normal admission.
Yeah.
No, it's not charging you triple the price. Normal admission fee, you get three times the fun. That sounds better, right?
Yeah. And I was going to say you should go ahead and fasten your seatbelts now and keep your hands inside the ride at all times, but probably maybe you want to get comfortable.
Yeah. Because
this might take a little while.
Yep. So get yourself a cup of coffee and a snack and hold on.
Yep.
Here we go.
What did we talk about on the last show?
Well, last show we did two groups of questions. So we did one on antennas, things like vertical and horizontal polarization, the concept of antenna gain, definition and types of beam antennas, antenna loading, common portable and mobile antennas, relationships between resonant length and frequency, and dipole pattern of all things. In the next section, we did feed lines, types, attenuation versus frequency, selecting, SWR concepts, antenna tuners and couplers, RF connector selecting, and weather protection.
And this time, we've got power circuits and hazards, hazardous voltages, fuses and circuit breakers, grounding, electrical code compliance, lightning protection, battery safety, also antenna safety, tower safety and grounding, installing antennas, antenna supports, and if that wasn't enough safety type stuff, RF hazards, radiation exposure, proximity to antennas, recognized safe power levels, radiation types, and duty cycles.
Which of the following is a safety hazard of a 12-volt storage battery? A, touching both terminals with hands can cause electrical shock.
B, shorting the terminals can cause burns, fires, or an explosion.
C, RF emissions from a nearby transmitter can cause electrolyte to emit poison gas.
Or D, all of these choices are correct. Which of the following is a safety hazard of a 12-volt storage battery? And that would be, I guess, like what's in your automobile or your UPS battery or any type of 12-volt battery. A, touching both terminals with the hands can cause electrical shock. No, touching both terminals with your tongue, that might cause a little shock, but it'd be hard to do
on a car battery.
Yeah.
Listen, Gene Simmons.
Yeah. C, RF emissions from a nearby transmitter can cause the electrolyte to emit poisonous gas. RF emissions? Nah. D, all of these choices, of course. Now, it is B. Shorting the terminals can cause burns, fire, or an explosion. That's what the chat room is saying.
Seen that happen.
Yep. And it is.
My dad was working on his old truck one time, and he disconnected the battery from the truck, but he laid the crescent wrench down, and it slid down and hit both of the terminals on the truck. Blew up in his face, knocked his teeth out, messed his eye up, did all kind of stuff.
Man.
It's a pretty bad deal, the car battery.
A guy I used to work with, it didn't blow the battery up, but he was taking a battery out, and he had a wrench removing it, and he had a metal bracelet on. And somehow it touched the wrench and one of the posts at the same time, and it arced and stuck, and he had to hold it there until it melted off enough that he could get it loose.
Yeah.
And he had a scar around his wrist.
I bet he still does.
Yeah.
Wow.
Dangerous stuff, man, on those high current batteries. What health hazard is presented by electrical current flowing through the body? A, it may cause injury by heating tissue.
B, it may disrupt the electrical functions of cells.
C, it may cause involuntary muscle contractions.
Or D, all these choices are correct. I'm thinking this might be D, but let me look at these again. Health hazard is presented by electrical current flowing through the body. May cause injury by heating tissue. I know for a fact that happened because I've seen somebody that got electrocuted before. May disrupt electrical functions of the cells. It may cause... I'm going with D. All these choices are correct. It's got to be. Because I know for sure if you get electrocuted, it makes your muscles contract.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got to be D. I know A, heating, too.
Yep.
Yeah, so I'm going with D. All these are correct.
I'll agree with you, and so does everyone else.
We had a guy at work was there painting. He had all kinds of stories tonight. He had a ladder, and he didn't want to turn it this way and carry it. He had it balanced, was carrying it. He hit the power line up there. Came through, hit his foot. The power came through, came out of his foot, went to the ground. Man, his foot looked like it was cooked from the inside, like a sausage on the grill. Swollen up and cracked open. It was really bad.
Yeah.
So I know for sure it can heat the tissue, no doubt.
Yep.
In the United States, what circuit does black wire insulation indicate in a 3-wire 120-volt cable? A, neutral.
B, hot.
C, equipment ground.
RD, black insulation is never used. Well, of course, black insulation is used. I think everybody knows that. It's kind of weird, you know. You got generally black and white, and then you got a ground conductor that doesn't have insulation.
Mm-hmm.
You would think black as being negative or being ground in, you know, the automobile.
Yeah, because it's red and black.
But that's not right. The hot is black.
Yeah.
You know, white is neutral.
Common.
But that's the way it is. So remember that, and you don't want to go messing around with your 120-volt AC and get those two backwards. I mean, you can, but there could be hazards down the road when you start connecting gear to it. So I'm going to say B, it's hot. Chat room says it's B. Do you concur?
I do concur. I know for sure that's right.
All right.
I hooked up a few of those black wires in my day.
What is the purpose of a fuse in an electrical circuit? A, to prevent power supply ripple from damaging a component.
B, to remove power in case of overload.
C, to limit current to prevent shocks.
Or D, all these choices are correct.
What's the purpose of a fuse? To prevent power supply ripple. No, from damaging a component. So you're going to rule out D too, because it's not all of them. B, to remove power in case of overload. That sounds like it. B, to limit current to prevent shocks. A fuse doesn't limit current, really. It It just interrupts it.
At a limit.
Yeah. I'm going to go with B. That's just what it is.
Chat room. I would agree with that.
They're all saying that.
Fuse doesn't limit the current. It just kind of cuts it off if it gets too much.
Yep. Why should a 5-amp fuse never be used to replace a 20-amp fuse? A, the larger fuse would be likely to blow because it is rated for high current.
B, the power supply ripple would greatly increase.
C, excessive current could cause a fire.
Or D, all these choices are correct. Well, they got a lot of D's. All these are correct on here tonight, don't they?
They do.
5-ampere fuse should never be replaced with a 20-ampere fuse because a larger fuse likely blow. No, that's opposite. Power supply ripple doesn't have anything to do with the power supply ripple. Excessive current would cause a fire. That's going to be it. It's not all these are correct either. I'm going with C. Excessive current could cause a fire. The reason I say that is because if you got a wire that's rated for 5 amps and fused for 5 amps, if you put a 20-amp fuse and you draw too much current through it, then it'll heat the wire. Can heat the wire and cause a problem.
Yep.
Heat generates somewhere and I cause a fire.
I agree with you. C. Chat room. I'll say and see.
I see. We're burning through these like nobody's business tonight, man.
Maybe we're using too big a fuse.
Maybe. What is a good way to guard against electrical shock at your station? A, use 3-wire cords and plugs for all AC powered equipment.
B, connect all AC power station equipment to a common safety ground.
C, install mechanical interlocks and high voltage circuits.
Or D, all of these choices are correct. What is a good way to guard against electrical shock at your station? Use 3-wire cords and plugs for all AC powered equipment. That sounds reasonable. B, connect all AC powered station equipment to a common safety ground. That sounds good. C, install mechanical interlocks and high voltage circuits like the lid on your amplifier. You know, if you got a tube type amplifier, ought to be a little interlock switch in there that if you take the cover off, it won't operate so that you don't electrocute yourself. I'm going to say D. All of these choices are correct. Chat room mostly saying D. And it is. Where should a lightning arrestor be installed in a coaxial feed line? A, at the output connector of a transceiver.
B, at the antenna feed point.
C, at the AC power service panel.
Or D, on a grounded panel near where the feed lines enter the building. D, on a grounded panel near where the feed lines enter the building. Where should lightning arrestor be installed in the coaxial feed line? Output connector of the transceiver? No. At the antenna feed point. No, that's at the AC power service panel. Or D, on a grounded panel near where the feed line. I'm going to go with D on this one. Grounded panel near where the feed line enters the building.
Yep, that would be the best place. Take care of that lightning before it comes in the building. They're saying D in the chat room.
Can't hardly trick that chat room.
It's tough. They will, you know, if you try hard enough. But you got to be persistent at it because they usually got them.
Where should a fuse or circuit breaker be installed in a 120-volt AC power circuit? A, in series with the hot conductor only.
B, in series with the hot and neutral conductors.
C, in parallel with the hot conductor only.
Or D, in parallel with the hot and neutral conductors. All right. First off, a fuse is always going to be connected in series. You don't ever hook it in parallel. Because if you hook it in parallel, you're not doing, anything but shorting out whatever it was you were trying to protect. So it's going to be in series. Where is a fuse? Okay, so it's only one fuse. If you looked at B there, in series with the hot and neutral conductors, you couldn't put one fuse in series with both of those without having them shorted. So it can't be that. It's C, I mean A.
Whoa, freaked me out there for a moment.
Yeah, it's A, in series with the hot conductor only. Agree?
I do agree.
Chat room does.
Installed a few of those in my day, too.
Yep.
Probably hundreds of them.
What should be done to all external ground rods or earth connections? A, waterproof them with silicon caulk. A, waterproof them with silicon caulk or electrical tape.
B, keep them as far apart as possible.
C, bond them together with a heavy wire or conductive strap.
Or D, tune them for resonance on the lowest frequency of operation. What should be done to all external ground rods or earth connections? Hey, we don't have all these are correct today, or this one. Waterproof them with silicone caulk? No, that's not it. Keep them as far apart as possible? I don't think that's it either. Bond them together with heavy wire or conductive strap? Or tune them for resonance? You don't tune them. So, yeah, I'm going with C on this one. Bond them together with heavy wire or conductive strap. Typically try to stay away from the ground questions, but you threw this one at me. I didn't have any choice, but
I didn't. Just be clear. I didn't throw it at you on my own. It was.
It just came with the luck of the draw.
Yep.
That's okay.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to agree with you. C makes good sense. Everybody thinks it does.
What hazard is caused by charging or discharging a battery too quickly? A, overheating or outgassing.
B, excessive output ripple.
C, half-wave rectification.
Or D, inverse memory effect. What hazard is caused by charging or discharging a battery too quickly? D, inverse memory effect. Man, I know what memory effect is. I've never heard of inverse memory effect.
No, but that's probably the good part.
Yeah, so no, it's not that. Half-wave rectification. A battery is DC, so there's no rectification going on there. B, excessive output ripple. Ripple generally comes from AC, so there wouldn't be any with a battery. A, overheating or outgassing. Yeah. I know definitely overheating, outgassing. I haven't thought about that, but seems like an unpleasant problem as well. Yeah.
Yeah. If a battery gets hot, a lead acid battery can let that.
Yeah, I guess it would. Yeah.
Kind of boils in there.
Everybody's saying A. And it is. Tom says, when it comes to grounds, Tommy has inverse memory effect.
I just usually run from those questions. It's like talking politics with somebody or something, man. People get kind of bent out of shape.
Well, yeah. Yeah. What hazard exists in a power supply immediately after turning it off? A, circulating currents in the DC filter.
B, leakage flux in the power transformer.
C, voltage transients from kickback diodes.
Or D, charge stored in filter capacitors. What hazard exists in a power supply immediately after turning it off? It says immediately. A, circulating currents in the DC filter. That's kind of funny. B, leakage flux in the power transformer. Not if you put a flux capacitor on there, right? Won't that take care of that?
Different kind of flux, I think.
Okay. So I'm shying away from A and B then. Voltage transients from kickback diodes, or D, charge stored in filter capacitors. That's going to go back to your TV example you were talking about earlier. I'm going with D, charge stored in filter capacitors, because those capacitors can knock the hoop.
Yeah,
stew out of you.
They're just as bad as grabbing it when the voltage was still there. And I guess, yeah, the voltage is still there.
Yeah, back when I was doing AC days a long time ago, some of the guys used to try to play tricks and throw people a capacitor when they took them out.
Oh, we did that at school, yeah. You take one and charge it up on a power supply and then
Toss it to them?
Yeah, throw it to one of your classmates.
I never did it. I didn't have the heart to do that to somebody.
Yeah,
I've seen somebody do it to somebody else before, though.
Yeah, you duck, man. Don't try to catch it. Mm-mm. So D, everybody said D.
Yeah. Which of the following precautions should be taken when measuring high voltages with a voltmeter? A, ensure the voltmeter has very low impedance.
B, ensure the voltmeter and leads are rated for use at the voltages to be measured.
C, ensure the circuit is grounded through the voltmeter.
D, ensure that the voltmeter is set to the correct frequency. Which of the following precautions should be taken when measuring high voltage with a voltmeter? B, ensure that the voltmeter has very low impedance. Now, that would be a very bad voltmeter. You want one with high impedance, actually, so that it doesn't load your circuit down when you put it across it there. But we're talking about high voltage here, so. D, ensure that the voltmeter is set to the correct frequency. You don't set the frequency on a voltmeter, so that's not it. C, ensure the circuit is grounded through the voltmeter. No, that doesn't seem like a very wise idea. B, ensure that the voltmeter and the leads are rated for use at the voltages to be measured. That makes good sense there.
That seems like a good idea.
Yeah. So I'm going to say B. Chat room is all saying B. Take a quick break here.
Okay.
Get a message, grab a snack, whatever, and come right back. Stick around any ham radio conversation, and ICOM is bound to come up. The reason is straightforward: solid receivers, clear audio, and a layout that feels natural the second you start operating. These radios are made for real on-the-air time, whether the bands are calm, crowded, or somewhere in between. When the gear stays out of your way and the contacts keep coming, you know you're in good company. Choose ICOM. If you're heading to Dayton Hamvention May 15th through 17th, make sure you stop by ICOM's booth. We'll have a few sneak peeks at upcoming products, so come say hello and see what's on the horizon. Hope to see you there. Remote ready, contest capable, and built for serious signal, step into the future of amateur radio with ICOM's powerhouse trio. The IC7760 HF 50 MHz digital transceiver, the ICPW2 1KW HF 50 MHz linear amplifier, and the all-new RC7760 remote controller. Designed to work in perfect harmony, this system offers full remote operation, high output performance, and seamless integration across the bands. The RC7760 remote control serves as an extra control head, and up to five can be registered to the RF deck, though only one can be active at a time. For wireless connectivity, simply connect a commercially available Wi-Fi access point via the LAN port. Whether you're working from the shack, the field, or a remote site, you'll experience crystal clear audio, digital precision, and amplifier-grade power, all from a single unified interface. It's the ideal setup for contesters, MCOM operators, and high-demand users who expect more from their gear. Together, they redefine what's possible in amateur radio, setting a new standard for global connectivity and reliability. The IC7300 MK2 builds upon everything operators loved about the original IC7300, elevating it to a sharper, cleaner, and more capable HF experience. Its improved RMDR, lower phase noise, enhanced cooling, and expanded I/O options make it the next level performer for serious operators who want crystal clear reception, rock solid transmit quality, and modern conveniences that fit today's operating styles. Also, check out Sirius Performance for Sirius operators with the IC9700 VHF UHF 1.2 GHz all-mode transceiver. For more information about ICOM's great amateur radios, contact icomamerica.com/amateur today. When we last saw our heroes, we were talking about high voltage leads, and I answered that question. So I'm going to ask you this one.
Meanwhile, back in Gotham City.
Which of the following is a good practice when installing ground wires on a tower for lightning protection? A, put a drip loop in the ground connection to prevent water damage to the ground system.
B, make sure all ground wire bends are right angles.
C, ensure the connections are short and direct.
Or D, all these choices are correct. And I can tell you right now, D's not right because the one I read for B is not the right thing to do. Ground wire bends should not be at right angles. Drip loop in the ground connection to prevent water damage to the ground system? No.
Sound like ground's going to get wet anyway.
Uh-huh. Kind of works a little bit better if it's got a little moisture down there anyhow.
Yeah.
C, ensure the connections are short and direct. That's going to be the one. C, Charlie.
It is.
All right. Definitely want them to be short and direct.
Possible. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you don't want to put any right angle bends. Lightning doesn't like to go around those corners like that.
Okay, here's one for you. You ready?
But let me say this.
Okay.
Let me say this, just so we get it right. We're talking about a ground connection, a ground wire.
Uh-huh.
You want it as straight as possible to the ground.
In short. Right?
Because lightning doesn't like to go around bends or in circles. It'd rather go shortest path to ground, most direct. If you're installing your feed line, it's kind of somewhat common practice right before you come in the building. Maybe put a few coils in your antenna lead there and then come in. So if lightning tried to come in that feed line, that would present a little impedance to it, you know.
I'd do mine at the bottom of the mast. So I've got a push-up pole.
Yeah.
Come straight down the push-up pole, and I got probably six or seven coils mm-hmm. of wire of the coax down there. Then it runs around the house, goes into my building where my shack is.
Yeah.
It should work, huh?
It should work. I mean, it's like the other thing about where you put your lightning arrestor right before the feed line comes in the building. That's the best place. But, you know, whatever, any of that is going to be better than the most direct path inside.
Well, I'm probably going to be redoing all that stuff in the next 2 weeks anyway. So
okay.
I'll just move the loops.
In the next 2 weeks, that sounds like you're not going to be around next week.
Probably. I'm going to be around somewhere. It's not around the shack. Okay. I'm going to be hamming it up in Ohio.
Ohio.
Ohio. Hamvention.
Hamvention. Looking forward to that.
Me too. Be first time I've been since the COVID stuff started.
I hope some of the folks in the chat room and some of those watching will be there as well.
Hope so.
Always a good event.
If you see us running around there, be sure and stop us and say hey. We always like to meet you people.
Yeah.
Some of you we've met, like to see, you know, again, but some of you that we haven't. Oh, it's cool. That's the best part of going to Hamvention.
Most of you we've met, we'd like to see again. It's only a few that we wouldn't like to see. No, really.
We'd like to. That's probably how it sounded. I didn't mean it like that. That's funny. Leave it to me.
You set it up, so I had to take it. You know.
May as well go ahead and hit the ball, man.
Yeah.
It came right over the home plate.
You got one for me?
I do have one. Here's a good one. This right up your alley, too, your old work. What's required when climbing an antenna tower? A, have sufficient training on safe tower climbing techniques.
B, use appropriate tie-off to the tower at all times.
C, always wear an approved climbing harness.
Or D, all of these choices are correct. What's required when climbing an antenna tower? A, have sufficient training on safe tower climbing techniques. Sounds like a good idea. B, use appropriate tie-off to the tower at all times. Yes, you should always be tied off to the tower. As a matter of fact, the professional crews I've used the last few years, they use two straps now.
Oh, yeah?
They're double tied to the tower. And as they climb and take this one off, put it above.
There's always one.
They've always at least one holding them.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
You need to be safe. I'm sure it slows you down, but you will actually make it down like that.
Bit slower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Slow. It's better to come down slow.
Yeah, no kidding. You don't want to brush that.
C, always wear an approved climbing harness. That sounds appropriate, too. So it's D. All of these choices are correct. Chat room. Yeah, they're saying D.
The ones that answered.
Yeah. Under what circumstances is it safe to climb a tower without a helper or observer? A, when no electrical work is being performed.
B, when no mechanical work is being performed.
C, when the work being done is not more than 20 feet above the ground.
Or D, never. Under what circumstances is it safe to climb a tower without a helper or observer? I'm going to tell you when I would climb it is never. Not without a helper or observer. If somebody there, if you have a problem, man, and you're up there, can't get down or whatever, or you fall, you don't have anybody to call an ambulance.
Yep.
So that's not a good idea. So I'm going with D, straight for the throat on this one. D, never.
That's what.
No him hawing around.
That's what they're saying in the chat room. All except for caps lock. They say in E, when your life insurance is all paid up.
And you want to go and pass it on to somebody.
Yeah. Never. Even a 20-foot fall, that could be catastrophic.
Oh, yeah. Break something real easy like that.
Yeah.
I guess it could be fatal too, depending on where what you fell on. Which of the following is an important safety precaution to observe when putting up an antenna tower? A, wear a ground strap connected to your wrist at all times.
B, insulate the base of the tower to avoid lightning strikes.
C, look for and stay clear of any overhead electrical wires.
Or D, all of these choices are correct. Which of the following is an important safety precaution to observe when putting up an antenna tower? Wearing a ground strap connected to your wrist at all time would be
kind of a moot point.
That won't do it. Insulate the base of the tower to avoid lightning strikes? No. C, look for and stay clear of all overhead electrical wires. That seems reasonable.
Yeah.
So we know it's not D, all of these choices. So it's C. Chat room's all saying C.
And I'm going to say B. If you insulate the base of the tower to avoid lightning strikes, if there's lightning out there, you got to worry about that. You probably shouldn't be doing that to start with.
Yeah.
I hope you have enough sense to not do that.
Yeah. there's any possibility of lightning anywhere nearby, stay on the ground. What is the purpose of a safety wire through a turnbuckle used to tension guy lines? A. Secure the guy line if the turnbuckle breaks.
B. Prevent loosening of the turnbuckle from vibration.
C. Provide a ground path for lightning strikes.
Or D. Provide an ability to measure that for proper tensioning. A safety wire. A turnbuckle, you can turn it with two wrenches or whatever. So I'm thinking it's going to be to prevent loosening of the turnbuckle from vibration. So you don't end up you're basically turnbuckle backing out and loosening your guy wire, your antenna, or antenna or your tower could come down or get a little slack in it.
Yeah, you don't want to change the tension on the guy wire. You don't. And that's how you do it. It's most everybody said B. That's the way it is on all the towers I've dealt with. Well, let me take that back. I have seen one or two that didn't have that in there, and I'm thinking, yeah, I don't want to mess with that. You know, it's, I'm glad that wasn't my tower.
What is the minimum safe distance from a power line to allow when installing an antenna? A, at the height of the antenna to the height of the power line and multiply by a factor of 1.5.
That's a lot of math.
I know.
B, the height of the power line above ground.
C, half wavelength at the operating frequency.
Or D, enough so that if the antenna falls, no part of it can come closer than 10 feet to the power wires. What is the minimum safe distance from a power line to allow when installing an antenna? Well, A, I don't know what you'd get if you did that calculation there, but that's not the way you do it. B, the height of the power line above ground. That doesn't really tell us much. C, half wavelength of the operating frequency. It's got nothing to do with killing yourself by letting the tower hit the power line. D makes most sense. Enough so if the antenna falls, no part of it will come closer than 10 feet to the power wires.
Yeah, it's the only one that really makes any sense at all, really.
Yeah. They're saying D, among some other things that aren't answers, but let's see. Is D. What'd they say in there? No way would I measure the height of the power line. No, that wouldn't be a good thing to measure, would it?
Not in typical sense.
Not with a metal tape measure, for sure. As far as you can get it. Yeah, Francis, that's a pretty good answer, too. But, yeah, at least minimum of 10 feet. Which of the following is an important safety rule to remember when using a crank-up tower? A, this type of tower must never be painted.
B, this type of tower must never be grounded.
C, this type of tower must not be climbed unless it is retracted or mechanical safety locking devices have been installed.
Or D, all these choices are correct. Well, I don't think it's D because I think it's okay to be grounded. Now, maybe it shouldn't be painted. I don't know. I could see where that could cause a problem. Possibly could cause a problem with it coming up and down.
Binding, yeah.
Yeah, but I think the right answer is going to be C. Tower must not be climbed unless it's retracted or mechanical safety locking device have been installed. You don't want to climb up that thing and have it break loose and come down with you on there.
No, no. Very dangerous.
Yeah. So I'm going with C, Charlie. This type of tower must never be climbed unless it's retracted.
Yada, yada, yada. I agree with you. Everybody in the chat room is
agreeing. That's when it makes sense, too. So.
Yep.
Which is a proper grounding method for a tower? A, single 4-foot ground rod driven to the ground no more than 12 inches from the base.
B, a ferrite core RF choke connected between the tower and ground.
C, a connection between the tower base and the cold water pipe.
Or D?
C, a connection between the tower base and a cold water pipe.
D, separate 8-foot ground rods for each tower leg bonded to the tower and each other. What's the proper grounding method for a tower? A, a single 4-foot ground. That's not much ground.
That's pretty minimal.
Yeah. B, ferrite core RF chokes connected between the tower. No. Definitely not. C, a connection between the tower base and a cold water pipe. If you want lightning coming in your house, that might be a good way to get it in there. D, separate 8-foot ground rods for each tower leg bonded to the tower and to each other. I mean, that's a good ground system there.
That should be really good ground.
Yeah. Say D. Chat room saying D.
Only time I've ever used a 4-foot ground rod is field day when it had to be pulled up. I just don't think we could have pulled up an 8-footer.
Yeah.
And to mention putting it into the ground.
I think it was so dry, we did good to get that 4-foot in there.
We've gotten them up everywhere except one.
Yeah.
So I feel bad for whoever cuts the grass at that other one.
All right. One more right here. Why should you avoid attaching an antenna to a utility pole? A, the antenna will not work properly because of induced voltages.
B, the 60 hertz radiations from the feed line may increase the SWR.
C, the antenna could contact high voltage power lines.
Or D, all these choices are correct. It's not going to be D. I don't think A's is going to be a thing. The antenna will not work properly because of induced voltages. C, B, the 60 hertz radiation from the feed line main cut. That's not going to increase the SWR. You might have some noise, electrical noise possibly. Or C, the antenna could contact high voltage power lines. That's the worrisome part right there. I'm going with C again on this one.
Well, I'm going to agree, and everybody in the chat room is as well. I'm going to say, if you hesitated for a moment and thought one of those others was the right answer, you probably should not be getting your license messing with antennas.
True.
You know, that was pretty self-explanatory there. If it didn't occur to you that was the correct answer.
It just seems pretty insane to even think about trying to put one up there.
Yeah. I mean, that should immediately come to mind. Never do that.
Which of the following is true when installing grounding conductors used for lightning protection? A, use only non-insulated wire.
B, wires must be carefully routed with precise right-angle bends.
C, sharp bends must be avoided.
D, common grounds must be avoided. Which of the following is true when installing grounding conductors used for lightning protection? A, use only non-insulated wire. It doesn't matter if the wire is insulated or not. So that's not that. B, wires must be carefully routed with precise right angle bends. We kind of talked about this earlier.
We did.
It's definitely not, you don't want any right angle bends in your ground wire. You want it straight as possible. C, sharp bends must be avoided. That's the answer. It's not D, common grounds must be avoided. I'm saying C, chat room saying C.
I see. It must be C.
It sounds like we've almost answered this question before.
Uh-huh.
something very close to it.
But they do have some variations in the question pool. So, but when you take your test, you don't get all these questions. You might just get one or the other variation.
Which of the following establishes grounding requirements for an amateur radio tower or antenna? A, FCC Part 97 rules.
B, local electrical codes.
C, FAA tower lighting regulations.
Or D, UL recommended practices. Which is fine, established grounding requirements for an amateur radio tower or antenna. I think it's going to be B, the local electrical codes. That would be the main governing thing because you got a local inspector.
Yeah.
I know I've never had one come by and check mine or anything, but I know that I'm pretty sure that would be a local regulated thing.
Yeah, the electrical stuff, you got to meet the local codes because if you're going to get inspected, that's who's going to do it. B. Everybody in the chat room said B.
I should have just watched the chat room and answered theirs.
Yeah.
What they did. What type of radiation are radio signals? A, gamma radiation.
B, ionizing radiation.
C, alpha radiation.
Or D, non-ionizing radiation. What type of radiation are radio signals? They're not gamma radiation, so strike out A.
So you're not going to Hulk out, huh?
No, they're not ionizing radiation, so not strike out B. They're not alpha radiation. Strike C. So that only leaves non-ionizing radiation. D. Chat room saying D. Which of the following frequencies does maximum permissible exposure have the lowest value? A, 3.5 megahertz.
B, 50 megahertz.
C, 440 megahertz.
Or D, 1,296 megahertz. I'm pretty sure it's going to be B, 50 megahertz. So I think your body is going to react differently at 50 megahertz.
Why? Why would you think that?
It just kind of came to me like a flash from the blue out of the sky.
All right. I'm going to say B. There's a little mix in the chat room there.
They must not have saw the same thing I saw.
Yeah, must not have. It's B. Safe levels of exposure based on demonstrated hazards have been established by the FCC. What you're looking for is maximum permissible exposure because the specific absorption rate, the SAR, varies with frequency. So does the MPE. Maximum permitted exposure, as shown in these charts right here. SAR, S-A-R, specific absorption rate, depends on the size of the body or body part expected and is highest where the body and body parts are naturally resonant. An adult-sized body is resonant at about 35 megahertz if the person is grounded and 70 megahertz if they're not grounded. Body parts are resonant at higher frequencies because they're smaller wavelengths. An adult's head is resonant at the much higher frequency of 400 megahertz. Above and below the ranges of the highest absorption, the body responds less and less to the RF energy, just like an antenna responds poorly to signals away from its natural resonant frequency. Frequencies at which the body has the highest SAR are from 30 to 1500 megahertz. That makes sense because are you talking about your whole length or are you talking about different parts of your body? Now, these are the reasons on the MPE graph where the limits for exposure are the lowest. For example, when comparing MPE for the amateur bands, 3.5, 50, 440, and 1,296 megahertz, you can see that the MPE is lowest at 50 megahertz and highest at 3.5. And there's two different rates of maximum permissible exposure. on the top chart there, we're talking about occupational and controlled exposure. You can see between 30 and 300 megahertz, they allow you the lowest power density. So that's where you're going to be affected the most, or your bodies and body parts are resonant most, is right there. So they'll only let you go to a power density of 1, whereas down at 3 megahertz, you could go up to 100 in the power density. Now, that's for occupational and controlled exposure. So for the general population and uncontrolled exposure, like you'd have with your ham radio set up, it's the same, but you can see the amount is lower. You can only go up to, that's what, approximately 0.5 or so. It doesn't change the range of frequencies. You can see 30 to 300 is where you've got the most problems. You can have the least power density exposure. And 1500 megahertz and above that, yeah, you can have up to 1 there. Now, when we're talking about the power density, how much power you're being exposed to, and we're also thinking about how long you're exposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can, say, walk into the field of an antenna, and you can hit the maximum amount that you can be exposed, but it's time averaged. If you're only there for a certain length of time, then you can back off again for a certain length of time, and then go back in closer. It's time averaged, so it's how long you stay there. It's like you put something in the microwave, and you hit the button at 100% power, your water's not going to get warm right off the bat. And if you turn it off, which would be the same as walking away, then come back, turn it on again, it's going to take a long time before that water finally gets enough radiation exposure that it actually begins to warm up.
Hmm.
So maybe not the best example, but just trying
yeah,
to say
it makes sense,
it's based on two things, the amount of the radiation and how long you're there, how long you're
exposed.
It's
actually
to
really
it.
The same thing.
Yeah.
The water
example pretty much is.
It's pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
Here's one for you. This is a tough one. How does the allowable power density for RF safety change if the duty cycle changes from 100% to 50%? A, increases by a factor of 3.
B, decreases by 50%.
C, increases by a factor of 2.
Or D, there is no adjustment allowed for a lower duty cycle. How does the allowable power density for RF safety change if duty cycle changes from 100% to 50%? Okay, the allowable power density, if it's right here, say it's at 1. If we move away, say instead of being there 100% of the time, we're only there 50% of the time, we could go increase it by a factor of 2, because we were only there for half the length of time, so we can stand more power since we're not there as long. Make any sense?
Yeah, it does. But they try to trick you with those other answers there.
Yeah. So I'm going to say it's C. The chat room is saying C.
So don't be fooled and say B.
Yeah. Same as the microwave explanation is what Tom's saying there. And yeah. What factor affects the RF exposure of people near an amateur station antenna? A, frequency and power level of the RF field.
B, distance from the antenna to a person.
C, radiation pattern of the antenna.
Or D, all these choices are correct. What affects the RF exposure of people near an amateur radio station antenna? Amateur station antenna. Frequency and power level. We just established that's factor. Distance from the antenna. Well, that's going to matter too. and the radiation pattern. I think it's going to be D. All these choices are correct. I think all those could matter.
I think you're correct. They can all matter. Everybody in the chat room over there is saying D. I believe that's it. It is. So we got through the first set of questions and also the RF exposure questions unscathed. Up next, well, no, we haven't got through unscathed. We've only just had half of the questions on RF exposure. We've got some more I've got to load up here.
Okay.
Well, while I'm doing that, let's take a look at this.
Around the 15th of each month, it's Amateur Radio's original and longest-running video podcast, AmateurLogic.tv, with hosts George Thomas, Tommy Martin, Emil Diodonay, and Mike Morneau.
Roughly, here's what I have. The bottom trace here is ground.
While the elements will jiggle some, they're actually not too bad. It's light.
After putting it together, I decided to test everything, so I ran in 12 volts, and I'm measuring the output here.
We're in the antenna switching matrix. Any one of our six broadcast transmitters could be connected to any of the 22 antennas.
I personally am so thrilled that George got the special award. Well deserved, my friend. That's really cool. Yeah,
what about the Super Bowl, Emil? Did you go to the Super Bowl or were you at home operating that night?
Tuning my amplifier and I lost power in the shack and went outside. The house lost power. And the whole neighborhood went out for about 30 minutes. I don't know what happened.
That explains a lot. Now we can take this and put it over inside our box. It's flush to the bottom. If we were to rotate, we can see that thing goes all the way through. So we'll have a hole in the bottom.
What ammunition do you use in there?
Actually, you can use black powder. You can use WD-40. You can use, you know, anything combustible. You just have to use the right quantity. And we assume no responsibility for mishaps.
Here's what it looks like after I've got them all soldered together and heat shrinked up. Okay, let's give it a try and see how it worked out. So there you have it, the hula loop. No, you can't null out the dogs barking.
I have two thin film solar cells to run this. Looks like a little mini weather satellite, actually. And I'm using a guitar string for the antennas.
I particularly like that last one there, $29.99. You can get a 50-foot garden hose extension cord combo.
Do not get cord wet.
Now, most of these J-poles are built with metal elements or tubing. The reason I chose wire for this one is the length of this particular one. So I wanted to hang it from the tree so I can hoist it up there.
Yeah.
Go fishing.
We couldn't find the reel.
Yeah. Is that what that is?
All right, Tommy, sing the theme song here. So you got one for me.
I do have one. It just happens to be right here. Why do exposure limits vary with frequency? A, lower frequency RF fields have more energy than higher frequency fields.
B, lower frequency RF fields do not penetrate the human body.
C, higher frequency RF fields are transient in nature.
Or D, the human body absorbs more RF energy at some frequencies than at others. Why do exposure limits vary with frequency? Well, we've kind of already talked about that. I'll just go straight to the right answer there. It's D. The human body absorbs more RF energy at some frequency than others. So I'm going to say it's D. Chat room saying it's D. And the reason, do you remember the reason why that is?
Because we're resonant at a certain range of frequencies.
Yep.
Like 30 to 300 megahertz, roughly.
Yep. If you're standing up, depends on whether you're on the ground or floating. I don't know how you'd float. I guess down on a concrete block, maybe. But, then your whole body, the resonant frequency of it would be closer down, you know, the 30 megahertz range. But your ear is going to be resonant at a much higher frequency.
I'm going to have to hook myself up to my nano VNA and see what my resonant frequency is.
In the next show, We'll be doing that. No, probably not.
But, probably not.
Yeah.
Unless I try it at home without anybody watching and see if I get something interesting.
Yeah, you may have brought up a good point. He's resonant at all amateur bands.
There you go.
He's kind of tall. Which of the following is an acceptable method to determine whether your station complies with FCC RF exposure regulations? A, by calculations based on FCC OET Bulletin 65.
B, by calculations based on computer modeling.
C, by measurement of fill strength using calibrated equipment.
Or D, all these choices are correct. Okay, which find is an acceptable method to determine if whether your station complies with FCC RF exposure regulations? My calculation is based on the FCC OET bulletin. Not familiar with that bulletin. Sounds official, though. My calculation based on computer modeling. I could see that. I can see that being an acceptable method. By measurement of field strength using calibrated equipment, that too. So there's two. I'm gonna go with A too. So I'm actually gonna say D is probably the answer. All these choices are correct. I'm not familiar with that bulletin, but I do know B and C should be acceptable methods. So yeah. I'm gonna assume A probably is too.
Okay.
So we'll go with D's the answer.
I'm going to agree with you, and everybody over in the chat room agrees with you as well. All of these choices are correct. But there's a better way for us hams. It's not listed as one of the answers there.
And it is.
And it is this right here. Go to ARRL.org/RF-exposure-calculator. And right here, you go in, it asks you a few questions. You tell it the power to your antenna, the mode duty cycle, depending on if you're going to be using single sideband or AM or CW or whatever, the gain of your antenna, your off-center fed, find the gain for it, and the frequency you're going to operate at. Click calculate there, and it will come back and tell you the values and whether or not from this, you can determine how close you can be to your antennas before you got to think about it.
Well, that's very interesting. I did not know this was there.
Yep. This just makes it simpler. And I assume this is using computer modeling right here when you enter in these values that computer's calculating it out for you.
What hazard is created by touching an antenna during a transmission? A, electrocution.
B, RF burn to skin.
C, radiation poisoning.
Or D, all of these choices are correct. Well, in this case, I think a lot of us, some of us have been there and done that and know the answer to it. I'll just go straight to it. It's B. RF burn to the skin. You ever touched your antenna while it's keyed up?
No, I don't do it because I don't want to get burns to my skin.
Yeah. That's a good reason not to do it.
Yeah.
They're saying B over in the chat room.
Have you?
I don't think I've done it since I was a ham, but back in the 11-meter days in the 70s, I think I touched an antenna while checking SWR one time and
burn from 4 watts. Yeah.
You can. You can really? Burn from that little bit. Enough that you'll let go. Now, I have been burnt by some worse things, but not just by grabbing it.
Uh-huh.
Which of the following actions can reduce exposure to RF radiation? A, relocate antennas.
B, relocate the transmitter.
C, increase the duty cycle.
Or D, all these choices are correct. Which finally can reduce exposure to RF radiation. Relocate the antenna. Well, that should work. relocate the transmitter, that shouldn't do anything. The antenna stays the same. Increase the duty cycle. That's the opposite of what you want to do, so it's not D either. I'm going with A, relocate the antenna. Antennas.
That's what they're saying over in the chat room. Makes good sense.
He's asking if these are questions from the technician pool. Yes, they are. They're the final ones from the technician pool.
Mm-hmm.
How can you make sure your station stays in compliance with RF safety regulations? A, by informing the FCC of any changes made in your station.
B, by reevaluating the station whenever an item in the transmitter or antenna system is changed.
C, by making sure your antennas have low SWR.
Or D, all of these choices are correct. How can you make sure your station stays in compliance with RF safety regulations? A, by informing the FCC. No, the FCC doesn't want ham radio operators calling them or emailing them whenever they make a change at their station. They just want you to do the right
thing. Can you imagine how many people that would take to answer that?
Yeah.
That would be a lot of calls.
They don't want to hear from you. They'd really rather not. B, by reevaluating the station whenever an item in the transmitter antenna system is changed. That makes sense. If you did that, then, you'd probably know if you're still safe or not. C, by making sure your antenna has low SWR. That didn't really change it. D, all of these choices are correct. We know it's not that. It's B.
Actually, I would think the low SWR would increase the exposure. More power coming out the antenna.
Probably would, but that
a little.
Some of that power is going to be riding on your feed line, so that's radiating too.
Oh yeah, true.
Not where it's useful, but it's B, and that's what the chat room's saying. Why is duty cycle one of the factors used to determine safe RF radiation exposure limits? A, it affects the average exposure to radiation.
B, it affects the peak exposure to radiation.
C, it takes into account the antenna feed line loss.
Or D, it takes into account the thermal effects of the final amplifier. Why is duty cycle one of the factors used? Determine safe RF exposure levels. It takes into account the thermal effects of the final. No, it's not D. It takes into account the antenna feed line loss. Doesn't do that either. It affects the peak exposure to radiation. Or it affects the average duty cycle. I think we spoke about this earlier, and it's going to be A, it affects the average exposure to radiation.
I'll agree with you, and the chat room does too. There you go.
So duty cycle is referring to the amount of time you're transmitting. So if you're like me and you transmit a little bit and you listen a lot, duty cycle is going to be pretty low.
Yeah. The RF exposure limits are determined by the average of how strong it is and how long you're exposed to it. The peak exposure would be if you were transmitting and just walked up to the antenna and walked right away within a second. That would be a peak.
The maximum, yeah.
Yeah. But the average would be over a period of time.
What is the definition of duty cycle during the averaging time for RF exposure? A, the difference between the lowest power output and the highest power output of a transmitter.
B, the difference between the PEP and average power output of a transmitter.
C, the percentage of time the transmitter is transmitting.
Or D, the percentage of time that the transmitter is not transmitting. Wow. What is the definition of duty cycle during the averaging time for RF exposure? This is kind of tricky here. A, the difference between the lowest power output and the highest power output of a transmitter. No. B, the difference between the PEP and average power output of the transmitter. No. C, and this is why it's tricky, the percentage of time that a transmitter is transmitting, or D, the percentage of time that a transmitter is not transmitting. Those two things are related.
Yeah, you can't have one without the other.
Yeah. I'm going to say it's C, though.
Yeah.
Chat room was saying C as well. How does RF radiation differ from ionizing radiation, radioactivity? A, RF radiation does not have sufficient energy to cause chemical changes in cells and damage DNA.
B, RF radiation can only be detected with an RF dosimeter.
C, RF radiation is limited in range to a few feet.
D, RF radiation is perfectly safe. Well, I'm not sure I'd go so far as to say D's right. And I wouldn't say that C's right either. So, you know, with an RF dosimeter, or different, how does RF radiation differ from ionizing radiation or radioactivity? I know RF, like Chernobyl, that can damage your DNA, cause cancer things. So I'm going to go with A. RF radiation does not have sufficient energy to cause chemical changes in cells and damage DNA.
I'll agree with you, and the chat room does as well. All right.
One Chernobyl there.
Yeah. One final question for tonight.
Who is responsible for ensuring that no person is exposed to RF energy above the FCC exposure limits? A, the FCC.
B, the station licensee.
Or C, anyone who is near an antenna.
Or D, the local zoning board. Who is responsible for ensuring that no person is exposed to RF energy above the FCC exposure limit? And we're talking about, in the case of amateur radio, it's pretty straightforward answer there. The FCC is not responsible for you exposing people to high RF.
Right. They care.
Yep.
They're not responsible.
Anyone who is near the antenna, they're not responsible, although maybe they shouldn't be there. They're not responsible. The local zoning board really wouldn't know. It's B, the station licensee. If you're transmitting, or if someone else is using your station to transmit with, you, the licensee, are responsible. B.
You really don't want to get the local zoning board involved in anything.
It's best to keep them out of it.
Out of everything.
Yep. John said, C is funny because everybody is near an antenna, or everybody carries an antenna now.
Yep.
Pretty much.
Got one in my pocket.
Got one on my wrist. You do too. And that
is all we got to say about that.
About the amateur technician exam. Well, that's not all we got to say about it. We just want to say we've been through all these questions. Do your final studies.
Go take your tests.
By June the 30th.
Dayton Hamvention is a great time to do it as well.
It is. There will be a lot of people doing it there.
If you're in the area, go by there and take your test.
Yep. Do go over your studies before you go. Take a calculator with you, but it can't have a memory. Well, you can't.
Can't be programmable.
Right. Can't be a programmable calculator.
No special function calculator. Just a basic calculator. Yep.
You can't use your phone. Because
Because they're not just phones.
Because they're not just calculators.
Yeah, or just phones. Yeah, you can't you can't use it though, because you can have data stored in there and all kind of things.
Yeah.
Not that anybody would cheat, but still.
Yeah. Find somewhere around that's going to be given the exam. Contact your local amateur radio club or a ham in the area. Or there are ways to go online and just search. For
ARRL has a list of testing sites and schedules. Yeah.
So we said by June the 30th, actually, probably most of the questions we've covered over the last few months will still be valid on the next question pool. They're just a few of them may be dropped. A few may be added to the next pool. Now, we haven't compared them to see what has changed. Generally, it's not that big a change, usually. But anyway, June the 30th on the current question pool that you've been studying on. With that, when is the next Ham College going to be?
The week after Dayton.
Now, that'll be the next Amateur Logic.
Oh, Ham College. Yep.
Yeah. Amateur Logic will be on May the 22nd.
I suspect it's going to be on the 29th. If we're ready.
If we're ready. We'll get back to you on that. If we're ready.
Tentatively for the 29th. Yep.
We will we'll post it around where you can find out when that's going to be. There's a good place to find out that kind of information. Facebook.com/group/HamCollege or /AmateurLogic.
Yep. You can follow us at Ham College on X or Twitter.
Or you can subscribe to groups.io/g/AmateurLogic mailing list.
That's what I would do, most likely.
Yeah, because we posted all those places as soon as we know the date and immediately
reminders before.
Yep.
So if you set up on groups.io, just don't get the digest. Go ahead and set it up to get the immediate emails when they come out, because otherwise you may miss it.
Yeah.
Because the digest only goes out once a day at night.
The next Ham College is probably going to be on a different YouTube channel. We've been discussing getting a Ham College YouTube channel separate of the Amateur Logic channel for the Ham College episodes, and that will probably be in effect when we start the general pool coming up here.
Yeah.
On the next episode, but we'll put all the details out.
Yeah, everything it'll be out for everybody to find it. Even if we'll probably put a video on the Amateur Logic one.
Yeah,
and telling you about it. Yeah. It should be everywhere, so in plenty of time for you to subscribe over there and set up everything.
Yeah,
a little bit there is for you to do.
Yeah. Anything else we need to mention?
I don't think so. If you're going to be in Dayton at Hamvention or Xenia, Hamvention, be sure and look us up. If you've got swag, where are you swag and represent, come by. Find us if you see us around. Get our picture taken. Take your picture. And we'll put it on Amateur Logic and get you one of the little Amateur Logic bumper stickers.
Mm-hmm.
I do have them with me.
Yeah. And if you want to know when we talked about a particular subject on Ham College or Amateur Logic, you can go to the wiki, amateurlogic.tv/wiki, and there you can see all the show notes of things in the past. And there's the coveted bumper stickers.
Yeah, we're not doing the faux gold this year, so doing the bumper stickers. So.
I haven't seen the faux gold PL259 connectors for sale in a while.
Probably a reason for that.
Well, they're not good RF conductors because it's not real gold.
That's probably why you're not finding them.
But, you haven't been to Hamvention in several years.
I haven't been since COVID, so I'm looking forward to going.
But I've been a few times, and I've been keeping an eye out. I have not seen them. Maybe this year, both of us looking.
Maybe we started a thing about that, and everybody's buying them all up.
Yeah. Somebody got the mother load.
Found a bunch of nose rings running around.
All right. hope to see some of you at Hamvention next week. We'll be there. One other thing I didn't mention that I wanted to mention tonight. I've got to be there actually a couple of days before Hamvention starts because, again, this year I'll be working with the folks at Contest University. And part of that's going to be streamed. They generally have four different rooms there that they're doing presentations in. And some of the presentations are joined all together into one single room. But room one will be streaming live during Contest University. And that's Thursday, May the 14th, 2026. I believe it starts at 7 to 5. Okay. Actually, at 7, I think they're having breakfast, but that's a good event if you're there and you want to participate in it. There is a charge, a registration fee, but it includes a good bit of things there for you. But if you're not going, then go to the DX Engineering YouTube channel, and there you can find the live streaming link and watch the stuff that's going on in room one. And even if you're not a contester, there is some very useful information there. You'll enjoy it. I'm not a contester, but I always enjoy the presentations because it's just good radio knowledge going on there. And lots of tips that you can use just on antennas or just different basic stuff, radio stuff.
When does it start?
It starts on
Thursday,
May the 14th. I've got to be there on Wednesday the 13th. So, yeah.
I'll be sliding into town sometime the 14th.
Yeah. Well, you can listen to it on your phone.
Yeah. Might do that.
Or the stuff will be archived, so you'll be able to see it later.
Yep. Also, wanted to mention, if you're there, be sure to go by the Icon booth. They've got a new radio they're going to be unveiling. I think it's probably going to be under glass. I don't know what it is. It's
something. Yeah, well, that number will change after the...
Oh, okay, that's like a code name.
That's like a code name, and there's been some sort of... Looks like AI-generated snippets what it might look like.
I'm kind of thinking it might be a 7100 replacement, but I have no idea, honestly.
None either. We have no advanced information of it.
Not none. I wish we did.
Yeah.
We couldn't say if we did, but I have none.
Yeah,
I think that would be a pretty cool thing.
But the little promos I've seen show two antennas on a mobile.
Oh, yeah?
Yep, and one of them looked like a dual-band antenna, and the other one looked like an HF antenna. So I think you...
They were from Icon? The videos were from Icon?
I believe it was, yeah.
Okay.
So I think you're on to something there. It could be.
That would be pretty awesome.
That would be awesome. Although 7100 is a nice unit. You got
it is.
One.
Yeah.
Are you going to put it in your truck to go to Hamvention?
I don't know.
If you don't,
I'm either going to put it in there or I'm going to put my 705 in there. I'm not driving my truck up there. Gas is $4.25 a gallon in some area up there.
Yeah.
So my truck gets like 17 miles a gallon going in the wife's car.
Well.
But I've got an antenna and a three-way mag mount.
Oh, you got one of those three-ways?
Yeah.
Okay, I do too.
I bought it at... Gigaparts when I was there.
Yeah. I mean, that'd be a good long trip. Good HF listening.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Worst case, I'll take my hotspot and my D-Star handy talkie, but I'm planning on putting at least a 705 in there.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for being here, everyone. We appreciate you watching. Those of you who are not hams yet, go take your exam, get licensed and, when you do, welcome to the hobby. And we will see some of you in Hamvention. We'll see the rest of you right here on May the 22nd on the next Amateur Logic, and we'll have some wrap-up video of what went on there.
Yep. Looking forward to it. 7-3, everybody. Good night.
7-3.
Such as types, attenuation versus frequency, selecting SWR concepts, antenna tuners and couplers, RF connectors, selecting and weather protection. Lots of fun things.
Selecting SWR. Is that what you said?
No. It's what it says. Okay. Selecting SWR concepts. Selecting. Okay, let me start that one all over again.
Which of the following is an acceptable method to determine whether your station complies with FCC RF exposure regulations?
Those regulations.